You're listening to the Trekmate Family Network.
The Battle Bridge is a proud member of the Tech Podcast Network. If it's tech, it's here. Please visit techpodcast.com.
Worf, Solus, Sue, report to the Battle Bridge. I'll join you in a moment.
Ensign, secure connector levels.
Aye, sir.
Crusher, Carteno, Gleason, report to the Battle Bridge.
Mr. Data, Mr. Worf, I have a special mission for you.
Note in ship's log that at this start time, I'm transferring command to the Battle Bridge.
You're listening to The Battle Bridge, where we discuss everything from Star Trek to Next Generation. Tonight's episode is The Schizoid Man. I'm Colin from Warwickshire in England.
I'm James from London.
And I'm Lou from Nebraska. Colin, where'd you say you were?
Warwickshire. Or as you would say, Warwickshire.
Warwickshire.
Yeah.
Okay. Wait a minute. Yorkshire? Yorkshire?
Warwickshire. Warwickshire.
Okay, I've never heard of Warwickshire. Okay, well, tell us a little about yourself. The people who haven't heard you already for, what, two or three times?
Yeah. if you haven't heard me before, why haven't you been listening to the back episodes for starters?
Yeah.
And if you haven't been listening to the back episodes, off you go. In the meantime, I've been in podcasting for a number of years. I think this is coming up on my sixth year now. I've been involved in podcasting. I am on the Trek FM network, where you can catch me on Melodic Treks. I'm on the Holosuite Media Network, where you can catch me on Frack Stars, which is a Battlestar Galactic podcast. I've guested on various Trekmate podcasts, including Delta, Alpha, and the Main podcast. And I've basically been a Star Trek fan for as long as I can remember, from, you know, knee-high to the grasshopper, watching it on BBC Two on a Saturday. So, which was when I got my hour of TV, and my hour of TV was Star Trek.
Okay. Well, it's good to have you on again. Let me see.
Yeah, it's good to be on.
Let me see when you will be on again. Ah, we're going to have you down next time for Time Squared.
I love that episode.
Yep. That's coming up in seven more. So we'll see you. We'll talk to you again on December 6th if everything works out good.
And Colin, you were last on for Conspiracy, if I'm not mistaken.
Yeah.
Was, not too long ago at all, really.
I mean, not from your perspective, no.
Okay. And you gave that one a 5. So as I was thinking about, when we get guests on that come on more than once, we give them a chance, since they've had reflection, to go back and can reconsider their position on that particular episode. So you're still good with the 5, or have you given it any thought?
No, I'm still good with the 5.
Okay. Because I gave it a 4.5 and James gave it a 5. So we're good. Okay. All right, then. Well, let's go ahead and head on into the synopsis.
The synopsis for tonight's show is: an away team discovers the dying doctor, Ida Graves, claims to be Data's grandfather. This is the 6th episode of Season 2 of Star Trek The Next Generation. The original release date is January 23rd, 1989. God, I bet that makes you feel old. Was it that long ago?
It was.
Oh, my God. It was written by Richard Manning and Hans Bleimer and directed by Les Landau. Guest stars include special guest appearance by Diana Mulder as Dr. Pulaski, which is interesting seeing as she's the ship's doctor and she's still a guest star. Morgan Shepherd as Ida Graves. Susie Plaxton, who's a brilliant actress, as Dr. Salar, complete with Vulcan ears. She's played an awful lot of characters in Star Trek, she has. Barbara Woods as Kira Bryan.
Okay.
Or Kareen. Morgan Shepherd's been in quite a few incarnations in Star Trek as well.
Yes, he has. I can only find for Susie only like three or four or so.
Yeah, she was Salar. She was...
Kalar, of course.
Kalar.
Yeah. She was an Andorian.
Yeah.
And Lady Q.
Oh, the Lady Q.
Lady Q, yes. Yeah. Yeah, she was Q's wife.
Yes.
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 Yeah. And they had finger sex.
Mm-hmm.
Which has got to be the most bizarre way of reproducing I've ever seen. Just touch fingers. Mm-hmm. Done. Sorted.
I wonder how many fingers Q has touched in this lifetime.
That was a funny scene, though, when J-Mo turns around and says,
That's it. Yeah. All right. Well, so what do we think about this episode? Colin, you're the guest. You go first.
I personally like this. A lot of people don't like this, but I actually like it. I think it's got some nice little quirky moments in it. I think it's a nice reflection of ego. Which, you know, Star Trek does reflect society quite well. The story of the mad android has been done in various things in various forms in science fiction. So I think this was a nice twist on it. But it also is, it's not just about like intelligence and people refusing to die and all that. It's also about power. Mm. Because as we find out, he can't control the body that he's in because he's not used to it. He doesn't understand it. And it's, you think about, like, you've got this much power, you've got this much strength, you know, what rights have you got to control what you now possess? So there's lots of things in it that obviously we'll discuss as we go along.
Yes, we will. Doctor?
Okay, I actually enjoyed this episode probably more than I objectively should. I do take all of Colin's points, and I do think that there are pieces in this episode certainly that would point you in, you know, that could have been used in a really, really great way. And I think it falls short in how it brings all of this together. And there are some kind of big plot holes, and I think there are big critical moments of the plot where I just don't think that people are acting in a reasonable way. But overall, I did enjoy it. I think I'm a sucker for Brent Spiner, and I think that he does very well this week. Had he not been as entertaining, maybe I would have been less charitable. Mm. Over to you, Luke.
Okay. I kind of say the same thing. Brent does knock this one out of the park, sort of. As far as the story, it's kind of mediocre to me. I'm still on middle. I'm in the middle, I'll be honest with you. But we'll talk about that later. Before we get into the show, however, let's go ahead and do some forum feedback. We really only have a couple to mention for Where Silence Has Least, Season 2, Episode 2. And, wow, it's a short one, Kieran. Kieran McDuff says, got to agree with James on this episode. It was one I always remember enjoying. I always thought the idea of a dangerously inquisitive Nigilim was a terrific one, although the hole in space thing always bothers me. Why would we see the other side of it? I suppose it depends on whether or not gravitational lensing. You know, James, can I have you read that? Because there are things in there you understand more than I do.
So, pick it up from gravitational lensing. Luke, do you know what gravitational lensing is?
No, I don't. I think you might have explained it. I'm not sure.
Would you like me to?
Would you?
I'll be happy to. So, so in the traditional kind of classical model of physics, so this is talking about like Isaac Newton and the very early concepts of optics, you would assume that if there was the moon and or a body between you and an origin of some light, you would assume that the light would either, you know, bounce against that body and you wouldn't be able to see the light from behind it, or it would just get through because nothing was in the way. So gravitational lensing basically is the way that a body that has mass will bend light around itself. So it's nothing to do with kind of like atmosphere or anything like that would also kind of like have a similar effect, but simply due to the mass of a body, if a light beam heads towards it, directly towards it, it will be bent around it to a certain extent.
Huh.
And that's a prediction through general relativity, and they see it out there. And as a result, what he's probably saying is that, okay, would you be able to see through the hole? Well, I don't think you would be able to see through a hole, because it just didn't really make sense. It seemed like a hole to somewhere else. And then it depends on whether or not gravitational lensing can occur around it. And he's basically saying, well, would you be able to see the other side of it? Because the light that traveled to it would have been bent around it. But I'm going to say that I don't really think that a hole would have mass. I'm just going to go, you know, out on a limb there. So I don't think we would have seen the gravitational lensing. Should I shut up now?
No.
Could I just interject there?
Go ahead.
See, I mean, you know, brilliant explanation of gravitational lensing in my brain today, cabbage. trust me, I'm confused. But still, I never seen it as anything. What I saw it was as he was basically, it was the cheese in the mousetrap, and that's all he was doing. He was dangling the cheese. Yeah. Whether or not there was anything there is irrelevant. It's basically, it was the cheese. And you're talking about a sentient being that can basically lock a galaxy-class starship in a void. So if he's capable of doing that, he's capable of making you see something that's not really there. So whether or not the hole was real was irrelevant to me. To me, it was just, here's the piece of cheese, go get it. And that's all that hole was.
No, I think that's the way it should be read, because otherwise it makes no sense, right? When you know, as we mentioned on the show, you go up to the hole and then you don't fall into the hole falls around you and all of that. I think that from a very early stage, I think the Yidam is playing with them. And the way that they try to put some pseudoscientific explanation around things, you know, with the magnification and stuff like that, to me, it just doesn't work. It doesn't work scientifically. So I would interpret it as really, you know, him screwing with them.
Yeah.
So, Colin, do you think maybe what your interpretation is similar to Voyager's telepathic picture plant?
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, I think so as well. I think there's a lot more in common with that than... I think it's an entirely same story, isn't it?
Just about. Yeah.
Shh, you can't say that.
Except for our story doesn't have...
They don't reuse stories on Star Trek. I mean, well, has anyone to fit that dream? Did the Naked Tom and the Naked Now is the same thing?
Maybe if they had Naomi in our story, they wouldn't have had to recreate it.
There you go. Okay. That was the missing link.
Seven was there too. Oh, well, anyway. Okay, well, let's go on. He says, it always seems to be a dull blue cloud that symbolizes nothingness in the next generation, though. It's the case in this episode. It's also the case in Remember Me when we see the edge of Dr. Crush's universe. Before that, I enjoyed the conversation about whether or not Klingons would turn off the holodeck safeties. I can't see a Klingon even bothering with the holodeck if the safeties were on. I agree that dying on the holodeck would probably be dishonorable a way to go, but I also think that's the risk they'd take. I'd imagine that dying in a training battle would also be dishonorable, but that is a risk that they wouldn't be learning anything. I think the holodeck would be treated the same way. You think?
There's also a problem with that as well.
Why?
Because we know from Enterprise that the Klingons got holo technology long before the Federation did.
Okay.
So the Klingons would be well used to holographic world. So the safeties and all that to them wouldn't even be a consideration.
Really? Do you think they wouldn't even have safeties?
No, because, you know, while a Klingon wouldn't go into battle with a bandage ready.
So they wouldn't have safeties at all?
No. And you know, because obviously Enterprise was made after TNG, as everyone knows. Right. But because they've now done that storyline where the Klingons get holographic technology by the time this rolls round, which is like basically more or less 200 years later, 150, 200 years later, they are well used to holographic technology.
But still, to die at the hands of a holographic object, do you think that...
But you're dying in combat.
Yeah. So it's just a combat, not who you're in combat with that matter.
Yeah.
Okay. All right. Whether or not Starfleet allow their Klingon officers to turn the safeties off is probably another issue. As you mentioned, Captain Janeway certainly objected to it. Maybe it's Starfleet rules and regulations are not allowed to do it, or maybe there are exceptions if it's against your culture's belief, as it could be the case of the Klingons. Okay. Regardless, he clearly didn't get enough of his anger out. Fighting with the Yamato Dora seemed to be out of character. Although I would accept the rats in a maze was getting to him mentally. I'm guessing Klingons don't like or possibly even hate guinea pigs. I'd also love to see what one looked like. A Klingon guinea pig?
They'd have fangs.
Yeah, I imagine. And they could kill you if they really wanted to. Fighting with the Yamato Dora seemed to be out of character. I think any man, it gets frustration built up. And so, no, I don't really see it out of character to fight with the door. It's just another thing that's just set him over the edge.
Mm.
I think my biggest disappointment with this episode is that we never see Nagilam again. I'm sure Picard's report to Starfleet recommended he be given a wide berth, but I didn't get the impression Nagilam was going to go away. I didn't get the impression Nagilam was going to be so easily restricted. He certainly seemed confident that he'd meet Picard again, and even there was a hint that they may have some common ground and curiosity. Perhaps no one could come up with a suitable plot to reintroduce the character. Now, one thing I want to say about that, then, if that's the case, he's going to report it to Starfleet, give it a wide berth. I don't get the impression that's just Nagilam spotting in space. I get a feeling he can move around anywhere he wants to go.
It's not to say he didn't move on to another race.
Yeah. I mean, would you agree that he could probably go where he wanted to go?
Well, someone with that amount of power, yeah.
Yeah, I would also agree with that.
Okay. So, excuse me, I got a little cough. One thing I'm glad we didn't see was a demonstration of procreation from Pulaski. Although I'm sure Riker would have taken one for the team, wouldn't you, Will? I don't know about Riker, but I'm sure Wesley might have been interested a little.
And by the way, the next quote of, yes, absolutely, I do concur wholeheartedly. Mm-hmm. Is that a reference to the Pulaski line above?
That's what it is. Yeah, we know where it's from, but it could be. So, yes, wholeheartedly. Then again, as I look at Pulaski standing next to Wesley in a freeze frame of tonight's episode, no, I don't think Wesley would really be interested in the old battle axe. Okay, a simple yes would have sufficed. A very interesting character, creating a real danger for the crew with some interesting puzzles, twists, and turns throughout. A few minor nitpicks, but otherwise a solid episode. So it's a 4 out of 5 for Kieran McDuff. And I gave it a 2, and James gave it a 4. So it looks like, James, somebody agreed with you. I'm still out there on my own.
No, he mentioned that right at the beginning. His first sentence was, got to agree with James on this episode.
Yeah, guess so.
So that was good. And also, we rolled on to Captain Proton, which is, this was definitely one of the scary episodes. As a matter of fact, I hated it so much, I remember skipping it on TV at least twice. I like it when Trek does mystery, but horror can be, and I'm afraid I'm going to pronounce this plus or minus for me. This has definitely become a better episode over the years for me, so how could I not give it a 5? Anytime you want to come back to something you're unsure of before deserves top marks. So it looks like Captain Proton is also a fan.
All right, Ben. Okay. So a real 5, not one of those, I don't know. Well, never mind.
Not a holographic.
I do think it is a unique episode, right? One way or another. It has a very, the atmosphere is very unique. The story is very unique.
And if you think this is their first stab at the horror genre, so to speak.
I think that's true.
It's very well done. And it's also one of the many times that Captain Picard threatens to blow up the ship, but still.
I always felt that that was one of the worst things that could happen while you're serving on a starship, that your captain thinks that actually, you know, it's time to cut your losses and blow up the damn ship, Picard.
No kidding. They should have learned that from Encounter at Farpoint.
Oh, indeed.
So, okay.
So, James, you're a TOS fan, aren't you?
I know, I do like TOS, but yes. I first came in with Next Gen.
So how would you think this compares to Cat's Paw?
Actually, I haven't seen Cat's Paw in a little while. So, I mean, as a slight tangent, I did start I got the Blu-rays for the TOS when they were remastered, and I watched them all. It happened, for some weird reason, I started at season 2, for whatever reason, and Cat's Paw is obviously the beginning of season 2. So I haven't seen Cat's Paw in a long, 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 long time, and probably longer than I've been listening to Trekmate. And I always remember feeling that it was a relatively fine episode, you know, middle of the road, nothing to write home about. But when I listened to some of the people, on Ten Forward and other places, there seemed to be a bit of hatred towards the episode. So since I've been told that not everyone thinks it's just a middle of the road episode and there's a bit of controversy, I haven't revisited it yet. And it's something that I should probably do. Because, I mean, is it as bad as what other people think?
No, it's of its time.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, it's of its time.
Black Cat and the three ghosts. Oh,
yeah. And the Muppets at the end.
Yeah, well.
Yeah. Actually, I know the little Muppets that they have, or, you know, the little figurines, dancing figurines things. Right? I have no problem with that at all. I mean, all television is going to be aged at a certain point, and you have to accept it as from where it came from. But I haven't gone back to Cat's Paw in a long time.
If you view it in the context of the time it was made, it's not an episode to be hated. I actually like Cat's Paw.
Actually, here goes. I'm going to give myself a challenge. Next week is Halloween. I'll watch it for Halloween.
There you go.
There you go.
That doesn't sound bad, does it?
No. And then you can come on and tell everyone what you think about it.
Sure.
Okay, that'll work for me.
Make a note of that, Luke. Otherwise, you'll figure.
Yeah, right. I've already forgotten. Okay, well, then, since everybody else seems to like Where Silence Has Lease, I have till the end of the season to reconsider my two. That's generally what we do. We'll reconsider everything and decide if we want to keep what we got or if we want to change it. Yeah. Okay.
At least a three, Liv. At least a three.
I might, just for you, make it a three. What do I get in return?
I'll come on again.
Oh! All right. Okay.
See, that's enough of your conversation.
There you go. It's either that or we're going to be very lonely for Times Squared. All right. Okay. Well, that was our forum for Where Silence Has Lease. So let's go back into today's show, The Schizoid Man. Now I want to do my medical log. It says, medical log, stardate 42437.5. Ira Graves is the only medical professional that I have not been able to sleep with. For years, he's lived on a remote planet where I couldn't find him. 8 hours ago, we monitored a message from his assistant urgently requesting medical aid. I can only hope we can reach him in time. I'm so horny.
That actually fits.
Doesn't it? Doesn't it feel good?
It would explain why the guy was on a planet all on his own, apart from his assistant,
mm-hmm.
to stay out of Pulaski's clutches. Uh-huh.
There you go. Yeah, and, you know, little does Pulaski know that his assistant is about 23 times hotter than she is. So, you know, I doubt really Pulaski would have a chance. But then again, after we meet the doctor, I don't know. Yeah, he'd probably take Pulaski.
Yeah. Although in hindsight, if you're hiding from Pulaski, it's probably not a good idea to name the planet after yourself.
Yeah. You know, that's another thing. I'm going to jump to number 8. So anyway, back to... We're rescuing Ira Graves from Graves' planet. Now, either that's a strange coincidence that can't be explained, or somebody named the planet after Dr. Graves. Maybe Ira himself? So, I'm going to go ahead, since nobody else has done this, I now want to take the time to welcome everybody here on the planet Earth to Robert's planet. Okay? this is now Robert's planet.
Oh, that's good. I thought you were going to lose world or something.
No, see, everyone must have thought that right now, but got you there. Anyway, this.
I suspect this thing about Graves World is that it was probably in the script as that, with, you know, brackets to be changed before airing, and they just didn't get around to it because they're never afraid of calling it, you know, Alpha, Beta, Gamma, 4 or whatever, right? It's easy enough to come up with a
unless name he found the planet.
Maybe. I do have one observation, though, which is that I think this is the third crazy scientist living on an isolated world that we've come across so far. We've only been here for 25 storylines or whatever it is.
Yeah. So I've already marooned three mad scientists.
Absolutely.
And I should correct myself that actually this isn't going to be Robert's planet. It should be Robert's world. It's more in line with Graves' world. And besides, I would not want to live on a planet called Graves.
No, doesn't fill you with hope.
No, glory. No, it doesn't. Okay, so before we even get to the story, let's get to the silly. Data summons Geordi and Deanna to visit him in his quarters so he can show them something. They arrive to find Geordi asking, "Did you damage your face, Data?" "It's a beard, Geordi. A fine, full, freaky beard." Okay, I was thinking, you know, at first maybe Geordi needs a new visor to ask him when he sees a beard, why did he damage his face? But then I thought about it some more. It's not real hair, it's more of a synthetic hair, so perhaps Geordi's visor doesn't see the same thing in Data's beard that he would in Riker's beard. So I can kind of understand the confusion, but would you guys agree to that at all?
No.
You don't agree?
No, I think his visor would be able to. I think it was his attempt at humor.
Did you damage your face, Data?
Yeah.
I mean, it's certainly what I use whenever I have, an old friend or something turn up with a beard. You'll say, "Whoa, Steve, did you damage your face?" So greet anyone you meet with a beard in that manner from now on, and you'll be a lot more successful and friendly.
Jennifer, did you damage your face? Oh, it's a beard. Sorry.
The thing that did puzzle me about this thing, though, is Deanna is laughing.
Oh, I know.
At his beard, and I'm thinking, so every time she sees Riker, is she secretly giggling?
Well, she did actually giggle at one time at Riker's beard, but yeah, you know, she was trying to do her best. Both her and Geordi were smirking and laughing. It looked like she was actually trying to do her best to appear to be more professional, while Geordi's about ready to lose it. Until the Data begins to stroke the beard thusly, then they both lost it. She went screaming out the door.
Which also leads, if Data's on the bridge and he sees Riker doing his Riker maneuver with his, you know, and he's stroking his beard, does Data think that he's thinking deeply? And you know,
even now I'm laughing at that. Well, anyway, okay, so. What do you guys think the whole point of this was? It doesn't change the story. You never see it again. What was the point? Did they just need to fill 2 minutes?
No, it's. I took it as them setting the thing about Data wanting to be human, which plays into the episode later with Ira criticizing him about the fact that he doesn't have anything about humanity.
Right.
So I think it was that was a setup for that.
Makes sense. Doctor, your thoughts?
Now, according to... By the way, I didn't read Memory Alpha on this initially, and I always assumed the beard was just a bit of silliness that they had. And, you know, and actually, by the way, I quite like the scene. I think it's a nice scene to show his continual struggle with becoming more human, and that's fine. But there is a passage mentioned in Memory Alpha on this that says that apparently there was an additional scene where a Data cut his hair and went bald as a way of emulating Picard. And apparently the beard is the way of emulating Riker. And I never put those two together. I never thought that it was him emulating Riker. I always thought it was just him doing whatever he was doing for his own sake. Now, I don't think that changes anything, but that was a little bit more interesting, at least.
That would have been interesting to see. So the beard didn't do it. He shaved his head to be more...
Yeah, apparently so.
Oh, my God, that's funny.
I mean, it's a little too slapsticky, yeah. Possibly, if he turned up at the end of the episode with a bald head, but I don't know. I think that's what they were trying to go for, and that just got removed.
Huh. Yeah. The other thing with the beard and all is he doesn't keep it.
Right. Not even...
Well, he turns up in the transporter room and it's gone.
Yeah. So, I'm also curious, do you guys think he actually is capable of growing it? Or do you think that was just something he put on?
No, I think it was something he put on.
Okay, I mean, it might be something he put on, but he does mention that he is able to grow hair. So he does control the, you know, whether his hair grows or not. I think that's from birthright when he's speaking to Bashir. So I think that he does have the ability to replenish his hair, whether that extends all the way to his all the way to his beard and, you know, other areas. I don't know. He also does mention that he's when Riker shaves his beard in Insurrection, right? It's not as smooth as an android's bottom, which I believe is what Riker was asking of.
Oh, that was good. Okay, well, then let's assume that he can grow his own beard. How would he get rid of it? Can he just retract it?
So, I'll computer, like that, retract James. The beard.
Yeah.
Computer, retract beard. And then Riker has his removed. What the hell? Okay. Anyway, all right, we're good. We're good with this one. Back to the story. The rescue of Ira. Well, I mean, it was just as quick that they got rid of that storyline. The rescue of Ira Grace from Graves World. Okay. We're on our way to helping Graves when a Mayday comes in from a transport that has 2012 settlers on board and their outer hull is breached. Graves is one man. So maybe we should just skip him. No, Riker has a solution. Near warp beaming. We could beam down to Graves' world and then slam to warp and take off and continue on the rescue mission in the Constantinople, I believe it was called. Are we really saying that the ship couldn't stay long enough to complete a simple transport before it had to take off? Or do you think that this is just for fun?
I think this is just, I think this is clearly just for fun, right? If you can't be sure that you're going to get there in time, and it's a serious issue that you do need to be there and there's a serious threat, then I don't think the additional 10 or 15 seconds is going to make much of a difference. But this is a way of just introducing a bit of urgency, right? Yeah. And actually, it's relatively unusual as well, right? It introduces... I didn't necessarily think that there was any need for them to do this, not just to be, you know, so quick in beaming down, but also even for the rest of the crew to disappear. Because, okay, you know, Ira Graves doesn't get beamed up perhaps as fast as he otherwise would have been, but you would have been able to find a way around that, even if he didn't have the ship keeping the rest of the crew busy. So I didn't, you know, there wasn't really like a huge payoff here. Uh-huh. It was just that they needed to be on the planet a little bit long enough for data to be taken over.
Mm. Mm. Before I comment on that, I just want to comment because we were talking about the beard. There is a line that plays into the humanity thing and all, which is what Geordi says, where he says, I think data is becoming more human than any of us realise.
Right.
That's what led me with the beard thinking into the Ira thinking into the other thinking. But the thing that made me laugh about this is the fact that Deanna is a graduate of the academy because she's an officer and she didn't know what near warp beaming was.
Might not have come up in her psychology class.
But she would have had to set the basics, so, you know, she would know what beaming is.
Yep, she carries the rank of lieutenant commander.
Yeah. So you would think she would know what near warp beaming is. And I also didn't get the bit about, for a moment I thought I was in the wall, and he says, you was. So how did they bounce back out the wall?
Before Doctor gives you a more logical explanation in science, I'm thinking that the computer chose the spot they actually materialized in. But as a ship jumped, that spot jumped too. And it had to be recompensated for to put them back where they were. But the thing that bothered me on that is now the computer is maybe a half a light year away at the time they now completed the beaming. What actually took over and completed the beaming?
Yeah. And also, why didn't the gravitation of the planet affect them forming a warp bubble?
Yeah. Doctor?
Over to you, James, to explain them two points.
Now we're going
to
sit back and listen to this.
No, actually, I'm going to be quite quick on this. Firstly, don't take a science lecture from a Klingon, even if you are Troy. It's not worth it. I don't think they were in a war. You couldn't have been in a war and then jump out of the war. Makes no sense. I think the valid point here is that you always have instances where something goes wrong during beaming. It happens a lot, you know, every couple of months at least. In the real world on the Enterprise, there will be an issue with beaming that someone has to like boost a containment beam or whatever it happens to be. But by this point, the Enterprise is half a light year away. So if this goes wrong, these guys are dead. I don't know why they just couldn't hang around for like the 3 or 4 seconds that it would have taken them to complete beaming.
Exactly my point. But so do you really don't think that anything I said about the computer selected that spot when the ship took off, that spot kind of went with it until it was recompensated?
I mean, it's all rather complicated, right? I think it's just too complicated for that to be
that easy.
Reasonable. And then how would these people be aware of, and what does it even mean that I felt like I was being materialized in a war? What basis of comparison does Troy have?
Yeah. How does she know what it's like to be in a wall?
I mean, this is something that obviously never comes up ever again, right? It's one of those things that is, you know, it tries to heighten a little bit of tension at the beginning of this episode. And actually, I mean, as I mentioned, I'm not entirely sure why they need it. Although, one point I will mention, I think, and this is Mike Langer, Pulaski pat on the back of the week, which is that she's actually absolutely right to decline the mission down to the planet if there are, you know, injured crew and other people on the other ship. So the fact that they send Dr. Salar is actually, you know, logical. All too often you'll see that, there's only one medically trained officer on the ship, and they will always be involved with, you know, whoever the most senior guy is, and will leave almost everyone else just to die horrendously on the side. So it was actually a logical, well thought through, sentence and a half there.
Sort of.
I like what you did there, James, referencing the logical scene as Dr. Salar's a Vulcan.
Mm-hmm. That was not intentional.
The only thing I would say is that they considered Graves extremely important, and therefore I kind of think the better Doctor should have beamed down. But we also know that Pulaski is afraid of the transporter, too.
Yeah, but she's also the chief medical officer of the entire ship, so they do comment on the fact that there's 2,000 people on the liner.
Yeah.
So she would have to oversee operations.
Yeah, that's where they get a pass on that one.
Yeah. Although she does come out with a cheesy line at the start of the episode where she says, saving someone's life is my number one priority or something like that.
Yeah, that has a bit of a groan on my side.
Okay. Let's see. The replacement, Dr. Salar. Graves admits for a doctor she's not bad looking. Yeah, I kind of agree. She's a little cold, it seems. I mean, a little colder, even colder for a normal Vulcan. But anyway, as we mentioned, this is her first appearance on TNG, and she'll be back for others. Now, what do you think of this one? Are you a Romulan?
Yeah, I didn't get that. I could understand her if she had said it to the Doctor, but not to Worf.
Not to Worf. Oh my God! I thought Worf was actually going to eat her for a second.
Yeah, it didn't make any sense. Just she basically insulted Worf, and then Graves insulted Worf, and it from two intention on two different angles. But no.
I mean, I think they're trying to use, you know, Worf as this, you know, the straight man that's getting a lot of the abuse here. Actually, the thing I'm going to call out here with, in particular, this Corrine, the actress that plays Corrine, I don't think she was very good. And I think that she was pretty wooden and stumbling in how, you know, she was delivering a lot of stuff. So I don't particularly like the line, but actually I don't particularly like the character either. It introduces later on. It introduces a little bit of a tension and a little bit of a something for Graves to be fighting for. But I just personally didn't like the lady.
She was just a little.
She didn't like Barbara Woods.
That's right.
Yeah.
Do you think? I don't know. I thought maybe she was just played a little dingy. I don't think I've ever seen her in anything else. So it's really hard to say what she would really be like.
Oh, and by the way, I mean, I don't mind the person. I'm just saying that I didn't care for the performance this week. Everyone can have a bad day, right?
You didn't like Corrine, in other words. Okay.
Yeah.
Can anybody explain what Graves mean when he says that Data has absolutely no aesthetic value whatsoever?
I like this. I actually like the fact that... I quite like the fact that the Graves character is like a doddery old man that's being offensive to everyone and stuff. I think that he is a contemporary of Nguyen Sung, and I think that he recognizes Data as being, as being and looking like Nguyen Sung. And when he mentions that he has no aesthetic value, I think he's just passing a comment about the fact that he looks like, Sung that he probably that he probably worked with or he probably had dealings with in the past. So I think he's just having a dig at Nguyen Sung in this case.
That's why he can obviously spot a Sung android.
Yeah, I think so.
Because he looks like him.
Although at this point we don't know that Sung type androids look like Dr. Sung, right? Because Dr. Sung hasn't kind of appeared yet. But that's how
he also does get a dig in about the fact that he taught Sung.
Yeah.
Taught him everything he knows. That makes him his Data's grandfather.
Yeah.
Grandpa. Okay.
But Graves is a cantankerous, rude, arrogant, misogynistic guy. You know, he'd have fitted right into TOS.
He would have fit into TOS better.
Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah. I can see that. But he lives on his own world. He can say what he wants to say. And I wonder what she did on this. It doesn't really say what she does for him. Corrine, can you put this on the shelf, please? No. Put it 3 inches to the right. Oh, God. No. Put it on a higher shelf. Thank you. I'm done.
But it's also, it's his character and all, is if you read about the story and the plot lines and how they came to be, he was actually going to be played by someone else. The guy from The Prisoner, Patrick McGowan. So it would have been interesting to see how he would have had the take on the character with the same script. But I personally think that Shepard does a brilliant performance.
Oh yeah,
you know, and it does remind me of when I was studying at college. There was a guy there who was so intelligent. He was way ahead of everyone else, and he would get frustrated with us mere mortals, because we couldn't comprehend what he was saying half the time, and he got frustrated with having to explain things. And I would imagine that's why someone like Ira would live on a planet on his own, so he didn't have to do that. He could just get on with his work.
Okay. And minor side note, actually, I remember meeting William Morgan Shepherd at Starbase Indy in 2009, and his voice is rather mesmerizing.
Yeah, and his voice is what, when you see him in his other roles, his voice, you just hone in on his voice.
Oh, yeah, absolutely.
You know, even because in all the other roles, he's got layers of makeup on, but you just hone straight in on his voice.
Yep. Absolutely.
I mean, by the way, I mean, maybe I'm just completely off on the side here, but I wasn't aware of the guy. So I am not aware of the guy's work, and I, you know, as you mentioned that he's been on Star Trek several times, I've actually only just, you know, now Googled him and seen who else he has played. But I think even before that, I got the impression that he was kind of, you know, Shakespearean in his training, and it does appear that to be the case. And as a result, the voice is the very, very, very significant part of that kind of a school of delivery, I suppose.
Yeah, like Patrick Stewart.
Indeed.
Well, you never know. Yes. I mean, he was born and raised in London, so he could have lived three doors down for you, James.
Yeah.
I thought he grew up in Ireland.
No. It says he was born and raised in London, England, according to IMDb. I don't know. Let's get him on the phone and ask him.
I was educated in Ireland, Sarah. My mistake.
Ah, well.
Educated in Ireland. Now that you've looked him up, James, and you know he's the Vulcan in J.J. Abrams' film, if you go onto Memory Alpha, we won't do it now because it'll take too long, but if you go onto Memory Alpha and Google his name on Memory Alpha, there's a nice quote at the top of the page about an interaction he had with J.J., which is really funny. Huh. So...
Just a second. Okay, yeah, I got it. The director was a slave driver. Oops, sorry, sir.
Sorry, I didn't realize you was the director.
Jeez. Hey, I'm kind of old. Give me a break. Okay.
Yeah.
Anyway. All right, so Graves has Darnay disease. You know, we don't really know who it's named after, but I'm sure Mr. or Miss Darnay must have been one pain in the ass in his or her last few years.
What you reckon his attitude is because of the disease?
Yeah. Yeah. That's what it says on the Memory Alpha about Darnay's disease. Pretty much everything that Dr. Salar said and everything we observed is what they described as Darnay's disease. It affects his brain and I forgot what else it was.
I just thought he was a cantankerous kid.
It probably was, but the disease made it worse.
I would just amplify
it. Amplified it, yeah. So, I don't know. Okay, somehow the crew of the Enterprise saved the day of the Constantinople. 46 people suffered injuries, mostly minor, so there was no reason Kate couldn't have gotten her booty call after all.
Yeah, if only she knew then what she knows now.
Yes. But the ship is heading back very, very quickly. We just only hope it be in time to save Dr. Graves, who likes whistling the song, If I Only Had a Heart, from The Wizard of Oz. Now, do you guys at all feel kind of cheated that we didn't even see the Constantinople, didn't see anybody sick, or absolutely nothing?
No, the only thing that puzzles me with these bit is they have subspace communications.
Yeah.
You think at some point someone rebutted in that he's got a terminal disease.
Mm. Oh, right. So Dr. Salar should have reported back to Pulaski and she would have said, you need to do this, 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 and this.
Yeah. You know, put him in stasis or do this and you can prolong his life for this long and blah, blah, blah. So, but they mentioned nothing. And he just says, we've saved the Constantinople. We're on our way back.
Very, very fast.
Yeah, very, very fast. But they don't say how fast.
Right.
But we do know from other episodes when they're in emergency situations, they don't actually go to warp 9 until they absolutely have to.
That's a good question. Do you think there are speed limits in space?
Not at the moment. That comes later.
Oh, okay. All right. Then Graves says Data's existence must be like a walking purgatory. Here's the thing I thought. If Data lives his life without knowing what desire is and is content about it, why does that make it a walking purgatory? And I thought, here's an interesting correlation that's stupid, in fact. If a dog knew what it would be like to go to the theater, order a big bucket of popcorn and soda, and watch a movie while chewing it, does that make his life something to pity?
Or you could look at it, you don't miss what you haven't got.
Right. You don't miss what you haven't got. So if my dog realized that he could go to the theater or get into a big bug of buttered popcorn and watch a movie, does knowing that fact make his life a walking purgatory?
I don't. The comparison that I made with Disley Cool Speech when he's having this exchange with Data is there's a Vulcan out in the lounge. You know, and the Vulcans don't. I mean, they have emotions. We know they have emotions, but they suppress them. So theoretically, she wouldn't have desire and stuff like that. Yet he has no problem with the Vulcans being like that, but he has a problem with Data being like that.
Right. Interesting. Doctor, anything?
No, actually, I did enjoy it. I liked that little speech that the Graves gave. I don't agree with it. I don't agree with the position where he's coming from. But I just read this as that from the scientist's perspective, from Graves' perspective, you know, he felt that a life without, you know, whatever desire, a life without, you know, all the characteristics that he deemed was important for his life, was not necessary life at all. Now, considering that the guy is, you know, being diagnosed with a terminal illness and he's just sitting there, I think it's perfectly within character for him to be, you know, for him to be thinking out loud in this manner. I don't think it's a, you know, I'm not going to call him up on, you know, Dr. Pulaski's, you know, a school of bigotry here. I just think it's more of him thinking, reflecting on his own life and, you know, thinking about how he lived it and where he, you know, what he perhaps would have preferred to do more of. So that's where
he's got nothing to lose.
Yeah.
By saying what he's thinking.
Yeah, and maybe it's just an inner reflection of, you know, of Graves' desires and how he perhaps should have acted upon them. And then he sees Data here who doesn't have these desires, and he thinks, well, you know, maybe stuff has engulfed Graves for so long that he doesn't quite know how to, you know, how to interact with Data when he has all of this effectively, you know, taken out of his life. He doesn't have the desires. He doesn't have the emotions. And as a result, he's, you know, he's able to say things like, well, you know, you're neither alive nor dead. You're, you know, somewhere in the middle. But I was just taking this as, you know, the ramblings of someone, you know, contemplating their own mortality.
I like that angle. Yep.
Absolutely. Okay, so now we find out why Grandpa isn't too worried about it much about his own death. Well, when we peel back the lady killer thing, we find out that he's planning to transfer his consciousness into a computer, thus cheating the Grim Reaper of its greatest prize. Okay, Doc, let's go for the scientific inaccuracy of the week. Number one, how is he planning to do that? And two, let's assume in the 24th century that they have the technology they have. Could he have done that?
This is one of the big plot holes, in my opinion. But you have to just go with it. Okay, could you transfer your consciousness and all your knowledge into a computer? Well, you can transfer your knowledge into a computer, but at the time of speaking, consciousness isn't really defined well enough in terms of a physical construct. It's at the moment, the best you'd be able to do is that, well, there are still philosophical arguments about whether or not it's an emergent property of a complicated network, or whether it is something that is a, you know, that is tangible or measurable, that you can, you know, that you could decompose into a binary stream or something like that. And so I don't think until we've got to the point where we can isolate consciousness, we have a way of answering this particularly well either way. But let's just assume that he's managed to be able to do it. I was surprised that he was able to get into Data with, I mean, what would it have been, like 20 minutes alone with Data? He managed to put himself there. I'm surprised that he was able to do that because, you know, with 20 minutes, I probably wouldn't be able to, you know, recompile, you know, my programs to work on a Mac if they were designed for a Windows system or something. So it was quite a quick turnaround. But then again, he is very clever.
He is very clever, but the question I was going to ask you, James, is the amount of information that would have been downloaded into Data even given the fact that, you know, they would have had blindingly fast internet connections and stuff like that.
Extremely fast Wi-Fi.
Extremely fast Wi-Fi, yeah. That would have been a huge chunk of information.
No, absolutely. It would have to be. I don't have any statistics this week, but it would be a huge amount. And here's a question, right? He transfers himself into Data, but then somehow dies at the same time. Why is that? If you are in a place where you can deem that you can copy the essence, you know, either the first thing, you know, the consciousness, the soul, for the better word, the information, the knowledge stored in an individual over to a computer. If you can do that and transfer yourself to a computer, you don't have to extract that from the human. You can just copy it. So if it's something that's copyable, then copy it. You don't have to, you know, and at that point you'd have two graves. You'd have one in the human and one in Data. Is it expected that it's a coincidence that the human graves died at the same time? Or,
no, I got the answer.
Or are they actually trying to extract something from the human to pass it through?
I think I got the answer. You ever, well, see, like in Windows, you have the option of copying a file or moving a file.
Right,
yeah. He accidentally clicked move. And as soon as the transfer was complete, he just fell apart.
I see.
But at what point does he die? That's the other thing. Does he die when the last piece of information is being transferred? You know, at what point does his body cease to be his body?
Well, technically, a move, if we're talking about Windows, a move is technically a copy followed by a delete.
Yes! There you go.
So the irony of ironies here is that actually he was probably alive up until the delete command got executed.
He transferred into Data, then hit delete and shut his body down.
He must have done.
Perfect. A perfect explanation. Yes, that's the one we're going to go with. If anybody disagrees, let us know. That's a good one. No. All right, but first, before he does that, Data, why on earth would Data even mention the off switch?
Oh, that made me laugh. That, I mean, Data tells anyone who asks he's got an off switch. You know, you would think if someone has your a way of completely shutting you down, you would not tell anyone.
No.
You know, but he tells Beverly, he tells Ira, he tells Geordi, Picard knows about it, you know.
And in the past, he's told people that he doesn't like telling people about where his off switch is.
Right.
As well. Yeah. And he's also been he's been outdone by people coming up to him and turning him off on more than one occasion.
Yeah.
So, I mean, Data's a very innocent guy, but at this point, you really should be learning about that.
Well, see, that's another thing. Yeah. In a future episode that we're going to do very, very soon, that's another thing. Riker is studying Data on a computer, and you could see the look on his face when he discovers that off switch.
Yes. Yeah, that is a brilliant episode.
Uh-huh.
I do love that episode. It's a brilliant episode. But, yeah, it's... So obviously it's on Star Trek medical files, so that basically means anyone with a certain ranking can access them files and go, oh, he's got an off switch.
Yeah.
And we all know how easy it is to steal files in the future.
Oh, yeah.
You know, so that's probably on the black market.
It's in Romulan hands by now.
Yeah, it's bound to be in Romulan hands, yeah. So the Romulans are like, nah, Data's nothing. All you can do is stand behind them and press her, yeah.
And also, you don't even need to press him, right? Because he got deactivated in Insurrection, you know, with a remote control.
Yeah, you've got to get the right Wi-Fi frequency, and then he's out.
So, I would imagine, by the way, that, well, I mean, when you're just looking at Data in isolation, you're probably okay. But if anyone did have like a race of, race of androids, very quickly you'd be, you know, just bringing ways of, you know, knocking them out from a, you know, effectively by over Wi-Fi, just taking them out with a, you know, with the off switch.
Oh, you just put Kirk in front of me and talk him to death.
Yeah. What kind of remote control would be needed to shut Data down? Just like a TV, don't click, he's off.
Yeah, it's just a modified tricorder.
Yeah, all right. So anyway, while Graves fondles Data for that off switch, we see that the ship is here. We see the ship is here and ready for everybody to beam up. But Data comes out and says he's gone. Ira Graves is dead, and it happened in Data's arms.
Yes. It's also nice to know that this is one of the things. It's not like in we get so used in Star Trek to them curing everything.
Yes.
It's nice every now and again where there is something they can't cure.
Yeah. Well, that's why Picard put in his log, shucks, we didn't make it.
Yeah.
Whatever Graves was doing is lost forever. Because in the 24th century, no one ever takes notes for others to continue the work. Especially when, you know, we live to be hundreds of years old, and no one could possibly have seen his death coming. So.
No, and all them computers in his office wasn't being used.
No, we don't know what's on them.
No, it's better encrypted.
Yeah, because exactly, it's encrypted. You know, the password 12345.
Yeah.
Oops, I got to change
his password.
Go ahead.
The password most commonly used is password.
Could be. Yeah.
No, it is. That's the most commonly used password. It is. Yeah.
Unless you change it up with the W0, you know, R something. Sometimes you can get past that way.
Yeah.
Sometimes. Yeah.
But it always tickles me. Data births and the actual word password.
Hold on here. We can talk if you want, but I'm going to Gibson Research Company website, and I'm going to put that password in and see perfect password. How long would it take to crack that password on the password haystack? Let's go password. Okay. For some reason, because it has it's all lowercase, has no digits, no symbols, no uppercase, it says an offline fast attack scenario would take 2.17 seconds. Massive cracking array scenario would take 0.00217 seconds. I guess that's 200.
That's not a good password.
No, that's not a good password. So,
not a good password.
Let's say we change that S to a 5 and that O to a 0. And we capitalize the first P. Now, password on offline fast attack would take 36.99 minutes, but a massive cracking array scenario would still only take 2.22 seconds.
So, actually, I have a question here, which is completely now unrelated to anything that we should be discussing.
Yeah, it totally was.
Which is, whenever you're cracking passwords, right, the only way to do it is you have to make numerous requests
right.
at the password system. Why not just cut them off after like two failed attempts? Doesn't that just solve the problem?
A lot of systems do cut you off after three attempts.
Yeah.
Because the only way you can get these passwords is to, you know, continually hit. And you know, that's the way you do it. You're hitting and hitting and hitting and hitting, and you know, obviously there are more and more complicated combinations and longer words and stuff not in dictionaries and stuff you go to, but you know, no one's actually going to sit there for, you know, 15 × 10⁸ attempts from the same, you know, ISP address within like 3 seconds trying to get into your, you know, into your Google Mail. To me, it just seems crazy that. You know, I don't think you're ever going to be able to get a human to be able to remember a password so obscure that you wouldn't be able to hit it within, you know, a couple of billion combinations. But, you know, the question as to why a server on the other side would effectively continue to acknowledge that request has always been beyond me.
It's a good point.
Yeah, a lot of websites do actually cut you off after free, but hackers don't actually go via the password. Hackers go through back doors.
Yes. Right. But even on the Lou Trek Show website, I've got something called Login Lockdown, which gives you five attempts in 10 minutes, and if you can't do it, you're locked out for 60. So.
But even saying that, they can try every 60 minutes, they can try five different things.
Right. But at that rate, it'd take them, you know, five forevers.
Yeah, true.
But anyway, that's a different story.
Star Trek.
Go on, Star Trek. Yeah, Star Trek. Well, yeah, back to Star Trek.
No, let me bring something up, which I think they've done now twice so far this season. I like the going into warp from 10 forward effect that they use, where they kind of burst through the warp barrier. That always, you know, I like that. And I think they don't use it much beyond season two, but they've had it on a couple of occasions so far. And they do have it in there as Kareen is, you know, sits standing in 10 forward and looking, you know, out at the starfield.
Yeah, I love that.
Yeah, that is.
Okay, so we go to the ready room. Data almost immediately starts to exhibit some strange behavior. We will try to honor him in the proper way, sir. I said we would, Data. I mean, you know, how could Data have possibly forgotten that?
Yeah, and there's also the whistling bit, because Data can't whistle.
Yes, he can't. That's true. Yes, he cannot. Until Grandpa showed him how.
Yeah. But, you know, because he makes a comment, I think it's in the very first episode, that he's trying to whistle.
Pop goes a weasel.
Yeah, and he just can't do it. So no one notices him standing by the turbo lift waiting for the doors to open, whistling.
Yeah, that comes a little later, but also they didn't notice him checking out the woman that walked by.
No.
I mean, that somebody should have seen both those things, and this is not right. So
he's trying to emulate Riker by growing the beard. I mean, that didn't work. He tried emulating Riker by just looking up at all the ensigns that walk by.
Yeah, but you can guarantee Riker would have just walked over casually and says, "Already done.
Already done." Yeah, forget her. I've already had her. She's not as good as she looks.
Yeah.
Okay. Anyway, Graves' funeral. Basically, he's in a torpedo about to be beamed into space when Data wants to say a few words. Can I just
ask you two a question?
Yeah.
Why do you think his coffin has a window?
I have to say, I love Data's eulogy on this, and I think that's really what we're going to be talking about here. But yeah, why do you have the service in a transporter room? To me, that seems silly. And why do you have the window on the torpedo? Why is it a torpedo in any case? I mean, can't you replicate a coffin? Finally, I mean, you just get beamed out into space until, you know, you manage to get recovered by a Ferengi ship that then sells you on as horse meat or something into the food chain. I don't think these are good ideas at all.
Oh, I didn't even think. You know what? About a week ago when I first watched this episode, I thought that exact same thing. He's just going to float till a Ferengi gets him and sells his pieces on the market. And I forgot to put that down when I did the notes again today.
And also, after the transport is complete, it starts tumbling.
Yes.
Where did the inertia come from to make it tumble?
That's a good point. And that's, yeah. Could he have been spinning while he was in transport? Could they put a spin on it?
Did you? Just wind it up before they let it go. Yes.
Exactly. But anyway, Data says, just look.
That's what the window's for, so you can enjoy the ride.
Right. Someone can see you.
Yeah.
Just look at that face. Actually, no, let's do look at that face. Did you even think that looked anything like Morgan Shepherd?
I think he had groovy burial clothes on.
Well, besides that, I don't think that was his face at all. It seemed like they either put in a stand-in or a wax mold or something.
No, that must have been him. I mean, it would have cost...
I perceived it was him, yeah.
I mean, I think it would have cost so much more money to do anything other than just get the actor to stand there.
Yeah, just... You know, it's far cheaper to put him in a silver, shiny jumpsuit, even if it was just from the waist up.
Okay.
And have him lie there.
No, I do see what you're saying, though, Lou. I think, you know, the fact that the hair's out of the way and, you know, he's not got his the creases in the face as much.
It's just something about it. It didn't look right. You know, and I like to hear what whoever responds to this in the forum. Tell me what you think.
Maybe the actor had already gone home.
Yeah, that's what I'm wondering. You know, obviously, Morgan wanted too much to stand in, or maybe it was claustrophobic, and they had to put something else in there, because it just doesn't, to me, it doesn't look anything like him.
Does he lose the beard, or lose p- part of the beard or something as well.
Oh.
He looks trimmed.
Yeah, I mean, but that's what they do, right? When
yeah,
when,
they do. They tidy your hair
when they come for you. Beard.
Yeah. Before they pickle you. They...
Well, yeah, I'm looking at the picture now, and you're right. It looks like they kept part of the... Jeez. Kept part of his... Hold on.
I mean, if they wanted to save... The thing that got me, if they wanted to save money, and they could have just had the torpedo sealed.
Right.
The cost of putting the window in the torpedo and creating a prosthetic and stuff like that would have been
exorbitant. And also the torpedo, you see the torpedo spinning through space, right? And you see his face in there. And, you know, that would have been expensive to do as well.
Yeah, so I don't think they would have gone to the extra expense of creating a wax him.
Hmm. Well, then maybe it was a CGI thing, perhaps, or what they're at the time CGI.
Yeah, the thing is now because these are in HD now because of the remastered ones, you tend to see things that you didn't see before because it's in a lot more detail. So. Did you watch it on Netflix, Lou, or...?
Did I what?
Did you watch it on Netflix?
Yes. Well, no, I've got the old DVDs. I don't have the Blu-rays.
Right. I watched it on Blu-ray, so I was noticing... I was noticing things that I hadn't noticed before because it's HD.
Well, grab a screenshot, send it to me. I'd like to see that. Then, what he looks like in the torpedo... In HD, because it just to me it looks nothing like him. But anyway, we gotta go.
I mean, it's like in Data when he's in the Red Room and he's being like, you know, facetious, and you get the close up of Data's face, and you're looking at him thinking in HD, I'm thinking, yeah, that makeup doesn't really match.
No. Oh, you're right there. Was it meant for HD?
Yeah, it wasn't meant for HD. So,
anyway, about that face, it's a face of a thinker, a warrior, a man for all seasons. He was all that and more, but he was not perfect. His greatest flaw that he was too selfless, cared too much for his fellow man, with nary a thought for himself. A man of unlimited accomplishments and unbridled modesty. What was missed was a man who was just so full of himself. Loved the sound of his own voice, or now at least the sound of Data's voice. To know him was to love him. I'm not doing all that.
No, no. Where's Picard?
Yes. Meeting? Shut up.
What? No. Hang on a second. You're missing the best bit. The best line is absolutely when he mentions that those who knew him loved him. Those who did not know him loved him from afar. Yeah. And I think that's absolutely fantastic. I think that... I mean, it's slightly. I mean, Picard gets annoyed with it, and that's. I'm surprised that Picard did get annoyed with it.
No, it was always with Picard.
Were you? I mean, maybe I've been to too many funeral services when this stuff has been going on. Yeah. But I actually liked it. I mean, it was obviously over the top, and obviously knowing the guy, you know, or having seen the guy previously, you do think, well, you know, you're certainly full of yourself. Let me ask a question now. By this point, is anyone thinking that Ira Graves is dead and is actually not in control of Data? Because I thought by this point it's absolutely clear that he is in Data wandering around having fun.
No, up until this point, they all think that he's dead and Data's just being weird.
Oh, no, sure. So I mean, one criticism I have about this about the show is that I think the crew are acting stupid because I think... By this point, it's crystal clear that Ira Graves is in Data's body. And as a viewer, I remember kind of knowing immediately that, you know, well, first of all, okay, you are given a bit more of a hint when he says, oh, I'm about to put myself through the computer. And then Data says, well, I'm a computer. And he goes, oh, really? So, you know, you're kind of given a hint on that respect. But by this point, you know full well that he's taken over Data's body. And the crew don't know, and they don't stumble across this for quite a while. And I'm surprised it takes them so long, because at this point, it's very clear that, you know, it's not Data who is speaking. Yeah.
No, and it's also Picard references later in the Red Room that he knew what he was working on. Mm-hmm. So you think he would have put the pieces together quicker.
Right.
Yeah.
Yeah. I think this is a case where they intended for everybody behind the camera to be completely ahead of everybody in front of the camera.
Well, we were certainly there.
Yeah. It was obvious. You're right. Because, Data's just getting...
Do you want that on your eulogy, by the way, James?
Without question.
Okay.
how do you want to word that, Colin?
I will say, this is James. To know him was to love him. And those who didn't know him loved him from afar.
Yes, okay.
By hearing his dulcet tones through the Battle Bridge podcast.
Yes. Yeah, but although we haven't decided if we're going to go on to DS9 and what the name of that would be. I see.
Well, sort of. We'll amend the eulogy as we go.
Yeah, exactly. But you see what I did just there? I just did there right now. I just planted the seeds for the next podcast here. And yeah. So I'm going to start watering it as we go along, see what James sprouts out as. So anyway... what about the glare he gives Picard when Picard puts his arm around Kareen? That was funny.
That was blatant as well.
Yeah.
And again, seeing as everyone is looking at Data, no one picks up on it.
Nope. Okay, so like we said,
the other thing at all before we move on is why isn't Deanna sensing consciousness?
I mean, Deanna can't sense much when she doesn't need to sense. When it's critical for her not to be able to sense something, she can't sense it. And when she needs to be able to sense something, she can sense, you know, anything, even inanimate objects over the void of space. So I generally think that one, I give that a pass generally because, I mean, Data's an android, but how are you going to sense stuff out of an android?
But Grant, he's supposed to have transferred his consciousness as well.
But that, I mean, okay, she does like sense Q's consciousness, and she does, she has had form sensing, like, you know, non-humanoid life. But I think if you try to kind of like logically tie any of this up, I would assume that she couldn't read the consciousness if it is present within, you know, within artificial life. That's what I would assume.
Mind you, Deanna's empathic or telepathic, depending on the plot needs. So maybe this was one of them instances where she might have had a headache.
You know the kind of crazy things I wonder? While you guys were just talking about...
Can you say them on air?
Huh?
Can you say them on air?
I'm going to. Since Deanna senses extreme emotions, and there's over 1,000 people on the ship, a lot of them have coupled up. What do you think she goes through in the middle of the night when, say, a third of the crew are engaged in romantic encounters?
Well, you learn to tune them out. She mentions she's that in a later TNG episode where you Beta side to learn control.
Mm.
And how to put walls up and stuff like that. So I presume she only lowers the walls in certain instances.
Good out.
I don't want to have to think about what these certain instances are. but actually, I'm going to have to correct myself, by the way, because in Descent, she feels emotions in Data and in Lore when they are given the emotion chip. So why, I mean, first of all, I don't think that makes sense. So on my logical path, I'm going to assume that's just nonsense. But if later she's shown to be able to feel emotions in Data, then you're right. She probably should have been able to feel Ira Graves being there. Although that would have been a pretty quick end to the story, right? I mean, Data would have beamed up. Or actually, no, Troy was on the on the ground, right? So as Data comes out and says Ira Graves is dead, Troy should have said, "No, Doctor, I'm afraid, you know, it's not going to work. Get out of Data," and then, you know, you're done before the second act starts.
Yeah, and then Worf shoots him, and then the words roll. and it's the shortest episode of TNG ever.
We'll fix them some other time.
Yeah.
For now, just put them in a corner.
Yeah. Geordi's having a quiet moment in engineering. It'll give him something to do at the weekend.
Right. Yeah. Defrag him. Okay. So, back on the bridge, Data is flippant with Wesley about what it would be like when he gets to his age. But then, bam! Blasts a captain with intense, bitter jealousy about Corrine. He says she does not... I'm not sure about... She does not care for older men or men with limited intellect. Now, who is that directed to? Because the camera goes right to Riker. So do you think that last one was for Riker?
Yeah.
See, the thing I think, Will could have had his way with Corrine at any time or any way he wanted, because like I said, she seems a little dingy. So I think Riker could easily have manipulated her into bed.
Yeah, he's throwing barbs at anyone that may be a competition, basically. Yeah.
Right. So you think Wesley was some competition, too?
Well, he's jealous of Wesley because he's young. Yeah,
that is true. You're right there. Mr. Data, you will come with me now. So anyway, Picard orders Data to engineer where LaForge can put the blue light around him, but they don't find anything wrong. What'd you think of that blue light? What was the purpose of that?
I mean, it wouldn't really be working if the blue light didn't come on.
Yeah.
But I did like Data sitting there, and he's like a bit of an unruly teenager or as a child trying to get a haircut, and he's just not sitting still. It's, you know, I like it. What saves this episode, I think it's Brent Spiner's performance, and I like the way that he has a you can see he's growing in his not necessarily insubordination, but in his cockiness, and he's you know pushing back at authority, in particular pushing back at Picard, from a relatively mild kind of change in character, it's now kind of gone out to full-on disobedience. Yeah. Nearly. And I quite like how that progresses.
Right, absolutely. So now it's time for Troy to use her psychotropic devices on him.
Okay, I need to come in here.
I bet you did.
What on earth is this about? I really don't get what this is about. This is, you've got a brain scanner, and you're putting a brain scanner on an android, and you're putting the brain scanner on an android's head. I mean, assuming that an android would have his brain activity located on his head in the same place a human would. I mean, even if you assume that he has, you've got these things going to work on an android and also work on a human. I just don't get it.
Yeah, and then it would make more sense if they plugged him into a TV.
Yeah, and get a USB stick out and shove it into the back end. And then they sit there and they obviously do some type of psychometric test and they find two personalities, and they almost say, well, we found two personalities in Data. And by the way, this isn't the first time that two personalities have embodied the same person. But we found two personalities. One is very much Data-like. The other one, almost appears to be like Ira Graves. I wonder what's happened here. And the crew are still stupid. They're not doing anything. They don't put two and two together yet.
The other thing that got me with that is earlier when Data says that he can run a diagnostic on himself, Picard says, go ahead, and he goes, yeah, I'm fine. And he goes, oh, okay then.
Actually, I thought that was very much like a teenager. He said, look, I am okay. I'm fine. No, what's the matter? I'm fine.
Yeah, no, you're not. Get to engineering.
Get to engineering.
No, James, you were describing every man's wife. What's wrong? Nothing. What's wrong? Nothing. What's wrong? Nothing. What's wrong? Well, I don't like the way you... Yeah, see, that. Usually it's about three or four before you finally get drilled to the bedrock of what you've done wrong.
Again.
Okay. So anyway, one personality is destroying...
Actually, I got to admit, I was watching that bit when she was doing the human test, and I was thinking, yeah, James is going to hate this bit.
Yes. Yes.
I mean, Troy is going to psychoanalyze
data
with brain scanning activity. What? I mean, someone should have pulled up that one, right? Much earlier.
Geordi would have made more sense analysing the brainwaves and a computer algorithm or something. That would have made more sense. Hmm. And then they say, oh, there's just two distinct brainwaves.
Hmm. Brainwaves in an android.
Yeah.
Okay. Well, anyway. So he said that the alien personality is destroying the weaker personality. That's when Picard realized, hey, Graves must have done something, and now we need to get him out.
But that also says that Data's weak-minded.
Right. The weaker personality.
Yeah. Which would, Data's a program.
Right. Shouldn't he have antivirus capabilities?
Yeah. Or, you know, and she's saying that she's actually attributing his program as a personality.
Yeah.
As opposed to our program.
Right. Okay. So anyway, Data now meets with Corrine to tell her, finally spill the guts and reveal that he is in fact Ira Graves, and now they could be together, and he could even put her in an android as well.
Yeah, right after I break your arm.
Yes. Yeah. Be with me or I'll break your arm. And he does. He breaks her arm. So Picard goes on the great android hunt and finds him in engineering, where Geordi and his staff have been all knocked out, which Data Graves calls accidents. Do you like how I did that? Data Graves?
Data Graves,
yeah. Data Graves.
Although I did think that engineering was quite likely staffed to die.
Yeah, looks like there's only two people on duty.
Yeah.
Yeah, so it's twice as staffed as normal then.
Yeah, that's true.
Yeah, it's normally just Geordi.
There was a poor ensign walking through when he got blasted.
There must have been switching shifts, and you had two people in there. One coming, one going, and they both got hit.
Yes. And since the second party was late getting to work, the first one had to suffer the accident too.
Yeah. That'll teach him to be late for work, won't it?
Yep. So Picard tries to talk to Data Graves and gets slapped down. Pulaski wakes up Picard, and they go to Data's quarters to find him on the floor with Graves out of his body. So where is Graves now?
There's two faults in these two clips.
Yeah, go on.
the first blindingly obvious one is Data hits Picard from one angle, and he falls to the opposite angle that he gets hit from. So the stunt didn't coordinate properly.
Right.
And the other thing is how did Data get into the computer when the computer was on the other side of the room?
Wi-Fi. That's not an issue, right? That's still Wi-Fi.
Bluetooth transfer.
Yeah, without question. Now, hang on. I'm going to go back to the showdown between Data and Picard, because I think that this is the part that could have perhaps saved the episode. Because I think that what we have up until now, we've got, you know, a mad scientist living alone. He happens to be dying. He has the opportunity for, you know, immortality. You know, is it possible for him to be able to transfer his consciousness, his essence into a machine? What does that mean anyway? And these are relatively big questions. And I think that we haven't really, these haven't really been asked yet. These haven't really been, you know, put out there and discussed. And we've just assumed that he's managed to get in there and it's all fine. And, I think that I'm just kind of not quite satisfied by the final discussion that takes place between Picard and Data, or, you know, Ira Graves and Picard, because Picard doesn't, you know, I mean, there's a little bit of discussion about, you know, mortality. There's a bit of discussion about, you know, that man versus machine, and, you know, in Ira Graves' position, you know, he has a, you know, he says that, you know, Data, if the choice was between Data and himself, there really was no choice to be made. I mean, that's okay, that's fine, but then you could easily get around that by saying, well, why don't we just make you another body? Is it appropriate for yourself to be transferred into another android that isn't Data, that didn't have, you know, inherent programming before you found him? But a lot of this doesn't really get raised, and instead Picard kind of plays the guilt card trip, which is basically that, you know, hey, you're a bit too strong in the body and you're going to, you know, upset people by, you know, by beating them up. And he, you know, he hits Picard and then he seems to agree with Picard and then downloads himself into the computer somewhere. I just thought it was a relatively weak ending, considering that at this point I think they needed it to be stronger at the end in order for the fun that we've had with a Data playing a possessed guy, and for them to really touch on the questions. I think it needed to be stronger at this point.
Yeah, it's the old solve the problem while getting a smack in the face.
Yeah, right.
Yeah, but yeah, it's. I mean, it does actually reference. He says, like, he's, what did he say? He's not even human. Iris says he's not even human. Like, being human is a superior life form.
Yeah, he says something like, you know, I am man and he is machine, and there was no question, you know, who was to live and what was to die. And
yeah.
I think that I would wanted that discussion to be deeper and for him to be argued out of that position instead of being. I got the impression that, you know, when they are calling over the comm to Sick Ben saying, hey, you know, this person who you thought you were, you know, going to spend eternity with, you nearly broke her wrist, or you did break her wrist, and isn't that upsetting? I didn't think that was the motivation that the character needed to effectively get out of a lifetime of immortality. Yeah. Would you give up immortality because you happen to have punched someone? I'm not convinced that you would.
No. And if breaking the wrist of the woman you love doesn't convince you that you can't control the body, then what will?
Unless you realize that what you've done is evil and you're becoming more evil and you will become even more evil as time goes on, and your morality takes over and makes you realize that this can't happen.
Yeah. Well, thankfully, Picard addresses Data's sentient nature in a few episodes time. So.
Yep.
We do get a redress on that in a certain way.
Okay. Well, obviously, I do seem to have a problem with having Ira Graves in the ship's computer now.
It's only the data.
What's that, Colin?
It's only the data. It's not actually him.
Right. But then again, you know, it was only the data in Data. But yet somehow he had some kind of consciousness in Data, so why couldn't he do the same thing to the ship's computer?
James?
Well, I mean, the implication here is that he was able to transfer his consciousness over when he went into Data, whether that's part of the knowledge and the data stream that he sent, or whether it's an inherent property of the positronic net, they didn't really mention. No. When he went into the computer, he lost that. I think fundamentally, this is not much more than just allowing the character to step out of the story, not commit suicide, but then not kind of be a threat in terms of, the obvious questions were that if you did have the inherent consciousness transferred to the computer, the question just then becomes, well, why doesn't he just spend his time having fun as the computer and, you know, opening turbo lift doors and shooting people in the holodeck and stuff like that?
Yeah.
So I think this is, in my mind, this is just a way of just neutralizing and getting us to the end of the story.
Luke.
I don't think it really makes a huge amount of sense.
Mm-hmm. Luke, don't ever upload James into the computer because we know now what he's going to do on a holodeck.
Absolutely. Yeah, we're going to see some funky things. May want to get the binars to help us out.
Yeah.
Okay.
Which also, if they back up the Enterprise computer periodically, then fine. But if not, then all of this information is lost when the ship is destroyed.
Ah, yeah. Right. All right, I'm out of notes. Anybody else got something?
No, I'm done.
I thought it was nice the trick they played on Data when he came back, and they told him that he was wrestling with a Klingon Targ, and that was fantastic.
Yeah, did I win?
Did I win?
Right.
And then we're kind of like, then we're out of here.
Yeah. Okay. But that was very much a TOS thing, end on a fun note.
Uh-huh.
And I was reminded a lot of what a little girl's made of in this story, where effectively, again, you know, they have a scientist. Why do these scientists work on isolated planets? I mean, you know, if I was a scientist, I wouldn't want to live in a cave somewhere on an isolated planet. You know, send me over to Hawaii or Florida where it's nice and warm. But yeah, on what a little girl's made of. Again, you've got this guy that is working on robotics, happens to find some stuff. He transfers his consciousness, and then, you know, what happens happens. And I found it to be a relatively similar kind of storyline.
Yeah, but you can't mention that, because then the references that they make to TNG, that Data is the only recorded android, don't make any sense.
Oh, did they say that? I mean, when
yeah,
did they make...
They do reference in TNG that there's no other... Data is the only recorded android in existence.
I thought it was only a Soon type android. I mean, we've already come across a Law.
No, they... Well, up until Law comes on the scene, they do reference that he's the only known android.
Oh, I don't know about that. I thought the same thing. He was the only Soon type android in existence.
Until Law comes along.
Right.
And then B4 comes along, and then Mommy comes along.
Well, because they, I think it's in A Measure of a Man. He's the only known Soon type android in existence.
Oh, okay.
No, not Measure of a Man. It was in, I can't think of the name, but when Data, the offspring, when Data has a child, the Admiral says, you know, they're the only two known Soon type androids in existence. If one lucky shot from a Romulan, they'd both be gone. So maybe I'm thinking different dialogue that you guys are.
I'll take 10 geek points off myself.
Yeah, whatever. It's the only show where the points don't matter.
Yeah.
Maybe the guys from What the Little Girls Made Of, maybe they were robots. Does, you know, is that an easy out? They were robots, not androids.
Well, yeah, I suppose so.
Okay. Let's see here. What else do we have? Well, that's it. So, if nothing, then it's now time to go on to our final thoughts and ratings for this episode. On a scale of 1 to 5, with 1 being the worst and 5 being the best. I'll go ahead and go first. It was nice to see Susie for the first time. She might have played her Vulcan part a little bit stiff, but other than that, I thought she was great. And really, she was even a cute little Vulcan, no less. I like her and Worf's dialogue together. They seem to play well, so there could be a future in them. We'll see. Graves is, egocentric and fun. I would have liked to see how he got himself into Data. You might think if we know how it was done, we won't be so surprised to find out that it was done. I knew what was going to happen when he discussed the off switch, so really there's no surprise to me. But again, I want to see how it was done, and even if it was true, then how Data removed Graves to the computer. Like you guys say, was it Wi-Fi, Bluetooth, USB wires? Did beam Graves out of Data? Something like that. Anyway, Corrine is a little haughty but very dingy, as I said. The rescue of the transport ship, nothing. Not one look at the ship, not one sick person. No one even died after asking for such an urgent mayday. So I kind of felt cheated by that. All in all, I was about to go in the middle of the road, gives us one a 3. But I'm upset that there was no Constantinople, so I'm going to 2.5. I'm not too incredibly hot on this episode, so I hope I'm not out of line, but we'll find out. Colin?
I actually like this episode. It's got some problems, yes. The ending, as James has said, was a week, and in some ways it felt hurried. Thought, we need to wrap this up. How can we wrap this up? Oh, I know. Let's make him regret what he's done and then stick him in a computer. But I do think that Brent Spiner, his acting credentials are clearly on display here. Susie Plankston is always nice to see, because I think she's a fantastic actress. And I think she pops up in several episodes, including some with Q, which we've already talked about. But to me, it's it misses a golden opportunity to expand on religious aspects. They missed the chances. If he's technically dead, then they could have explored the no one brought up the thing about the soul. Is he dead? If he's so, is his consciousness, his soul? They could have gone down that route. There's also the problems, like James says, where the crew seem a bit thick. You know, they're supposed to be the brightest of everyone in Starfleet. I mean, even Wesley didn't click that it's not Data, which was a shock. You know, I don't get why the opening monologue was the chief medical officer, and then you never see her again. I didn't get that. I mean, was it they had to give her something to do, so therefore we'll stick her on at the start, and then you're never going to see her for the rest of the episode? I didn't get that. And it also didn't get that because she clearly makes a point at the start that this is one of her idols. And he's the greatest mind in the universe, she says. So you would have thought she would have wanted to have some sort of contact with him, even in the android form that he was in. So I didn't get that bit either. But the ending is what lets it down. So the ending is why it loses marks for me. So I'll give it a
3.5. 3.5. Okay, James?
Okay, I think... This is hard. This is very hard for me because I love this episode. I think this is great. I really enjoyed it, and I always remember this episode as, I mean, but and as it's pretty well known, I'm a Data guy. I like him. I like Brent Spiner as well, and he does his acting and stuff. I mean, I even like things like Masks and stuff at the tail end of the series. So I do, you know, I do enjoy it, and I do like what they're trying to do here. Unfortunately, I just think that there was so much good stuff on the table that they could have, that they could have used, and I think they do their absolute best not to do it any, you know, do it any, give it any justice here. So they swerve around the issues. I had never noticed until we watching for this that Troy does bring out the brain scanners and tries to use them on an android, that kind of stuff. So there was, you know, so that doesn't ruin the episode in my mind. It's, you know, this is the nitpicks that you find when you're rewatching, you know, many times and specifically looking for things to talk about. I don't know how I'm going to fall on this because I think it deserves to go somewhere between a 3 and a 4, but I don't do half points. And it's just one of those things. I think that in my mind, I mean, this well-executed, you know, tighter story, I think this could have been like a top episode of, of TNG. And the concepts that are on the cards here are, you know, effectively the same concepts that are on the cards for Measure of Man or The Offspring that are certainly, you know, top quality episodes. I think that it loses a lot being in terms of how it gets it onto the screen, but I always enjoy it so much, so I'm really torn. I think I'm coming down on a 3 though.
I guess right.
And I'll leave it at 3. I think it's an average episode of, you know, an average episode of TNG. Although in my mind, by the way, it's, you know, 3 in my mind is one thumb up.
Okay.
That's what I, in my mind, I've got this concept of a thumbs down, a thumbs neutral, one thumb up, two thumb up, and five and three thumbs up for the 5-star episodes.
Interesting.
So it's coming as a 3 for me.
Okay, I guessed right. So our average after 6 episodes, the first 6 episodes is, I'm at a 2.67. James is better at a 3.17, and our guests, 4 of them so far, are at a 3.38. So the guests still like it better than we do. That doesn't mean that. Okay, then. All right. Anything else you guys want to do? Say?
No.
Okay.
No, I think I'm done.
All right.
Next time on Star Trek, The Next Generation.
Torpedoes ready, Commander.
The crew destroys a vessel infested with a mysterious disease.
They died of old age.
Dr. Pulaski risks her life to find a cure.
Doctor, I want you back aboard this ship.
Now, she's old before her time, and her time is running out. On Star Trek, The Next Generation.
Well, join us next week as we review Season 2, Episode 7, Unnatural Selection. I'm Lou from Nebraska.
And I'm James from London.
And I'm Colin from England.
Thank you very much for coming on, Colin, and we'll see you in 7 episodes.
Look forward to it. Thanks a lot, guys.
Bye-bye.
And good night.
Good night.